This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. Coming up tonight on 1A Plus with Jen White, baseball is playing by new rules, and local community teams are seeing a surge of local interest. Celebrate the summer of baseball tonight at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, if you've bought a new car recently, especially an electric vehicle, there is a chance it did not come with a receiver for an AM radio signal. Automakers say the technology is becoming obsolete and that most people listen instead to FM, satellite radio, or online streaming. Some public safety officials have raised concerns about the need for AM radio in vehicles for emergency broadcast situations. A bipartisan group of lawmakers have now introduced a bill called the AM for Every Vehicle Act that would require car manufacturers to keep AM radio in their vehicles at no additional cost to the consumer. During a House committee hearing this morning, Democratic Representative Frank Pallone of New York noted the important role AM radio played in the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy.
States as far west as Kentucky suffered power outages that lasted for days. Communications infrastructure was heavily damaged, including 25% of cellular towers across 10 states. Now, some of my constituents went days without power and telephone and internet connections, largely isolated and seeking whatever information they could get. A number of them relied on broadcast AM radio stations to get up-to-the-minute information, like where to get water, gas, and groceries. And in some cases, their best source for AM radio was their vehicle.
Facing pushback from some lawmakers, Ford recently reversed its plan to remove AM radio from vehicles, but at least seven other major automakers continue to move forward without AM. So what do you think? 1-800-642-1234. You may be hearing us now on the AM dial in Stevens Point or Madison. Would you miss it if it were gone? When's the last time you've gone across the AM dial to find out what's there? And what did you find? 1-800-642-1234. Could you go without the AM radio? You can also comment on our Ideas Network Facebook page. Our guest, Noah Arsenault, is a radio historian and a professor at San Diego State University's School of Journalism and Media Studies. Noah, welcome to Central Time.
Welcome. It's really good to be here. You know, I would say good afternoon, but when this thing goes online and people listen to it on different time zones, let's just say good whatever time of day it is where you are.
Yes. You recently wrote an opinion column for the San Diego Union-Tribune about making the case against removing AM radio from cars. Tell us a little bit about your argument.
Before I get into that, I just want to, you know, give a little context. I went to a conference for the Radio Preservation Task Force. Yes, there is actually a Radio Preservation Task Force. A lot of people, including people from, you know, other countries as well. This group was started in 2014 by the National Recording Preservation Board and in association with the Library of Congress. And it's to encourage study of radio by academics like me, the documentation of radio, where recordings exist, find out so people can share information. And anyway, I came out of that conference. I think I was actually in an Uber or a Lyft coming home from the airport. And I heard this guy on the radio talking about, oh, they're going to get rid of AM radio in cars. And I said, that's a bad idea. So I immediately was enthused and energized by the conference. It's so great to be around like-minded people geeking out about radio for a few days. So I wrote that editorial. And basically, not everything that's new is better than what came before. And I think people of a certain age realize that. Just because something is new doesn't mean it's better. AM radio is incredibly old, you know, at least 100 years old, if not older, depending upon how you define broadcasting. But it works. It's very effective in the time of crisis. The AM signal doesn't sound as good as FM, which is why FM has music. But the signal can actually travel further, especially at night when it's bouncing off the atmosphere. And it's just a great way to bridge long distances, which are especially important in a time of crisis. And I think when these auto manufacturers were making this decision, they assume everyone, if you can afford a car, cars are very expensive. Well, then you must pay $20 a month for Spotify or whatever it costs. And who listens to AM radio anyway? And to me, that's just like perpetuating this digital divide to just assume that everybody of means, everybody who matters, can listen to online radio. Not everyone has a smartphone. Not everyone has Wi-Fi. AM radio is everywhere. I think according to Nielsen, the studies are about, you know, 2 years old, maybe a year old, some lag time. Radio is the most consumed form of media in the United States. over 90% of the public hears it on a weekly basis. Tens of millions of people listen to it every week. It's not as sexy as the newest TikTok dance craze, but it's there and it's the good old reliable radio. So that's my argument in a nutshell, that we shouldn't just get rid of it.
Sure. Noah Arsenault, what do we lose if we lose the AM radio band?
I think that there could be a potential disaster where it is difficult, if not impossible, to reach people who need to be reached. There was a train accident in Minot, North Dakota. It's become the poster child of what happens when radio is overly commercialized, overly automated, and not responsive to local communities. There was a train crash. It's probably closer to Wisconsin, you know, a train crash in North Dakota. Some type of poison gas is released, like something out of a movie. The officials want to contact the local radio stations to say, hey, get out of town. There's this poison gas coming. And they couldn't contact anyone because everything was being remote controlled from other places. You know, like just the DJ stuff was canned, as they say. The music was automated from a computer. And I think if you lose AM, you're going to lose a lot of this sort of local flavor, the hometown touch, these small AM stations, which still exist. And I think it would be a shame if we, you know, got rid of it. It would be a continuing trend in the homogenization and commercialization of mass media, which few of us are in favor of.
That's an interesting point. Noah Arsenault, our guest, radio historian, professor at San Diego State University School of Journalism and Media Studies, and would be interested in knowing from you whether or not you'd miss the AM radio band if it were gone, or if you have a new car without AM radio in it, is it something that you find you probably can't do without, or can do without? 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Join us up on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Part of the congressional hearing this morning included a statement from the FCC that found that AM stations are more likely than FM stations or other kinds of media outlets to be owned by women or people of color. And what does that say about the disconnect between what some car manufacturers are considering and the reach of what this AM band can do, Noah?
I think I didn't actually realize that. I suspected something might be the case, but in many communities, there are groups who do not speak English. There's more than Spanish language radio. I'm studying French language radio in Southern Louisiana. I'm actually in a conference room at LSU right now. And there's, you know, different immigrant communities, different communities from a diaspora. And oftentimes AM is a little bit less expensive. It could be a very small AM station reaching a very, very small local community. And I guarantee anybody who listens to something in their home tongue is going to miss that radio broadcast when it's gone. Because radio broadcasting in your language, if it's not the dominant language of a country, is just incredibly powerful.
Obviously, I'm a radio guy, and for me, it's always been finding a faraway classic country station on the AM band. And for some reason, for me, classic country just sounds better with the low fidelity of AM. But I can also...
I could see that. You know, certain music, we probably like similar kind of music, you know, the crackle and hiss and pop of the old vinyl. That's fine with me. I don't mind.
Exactly. Also going across the AM band, I find languages that I don't understand, but I understand that those are important connections to communities across the country that don't necessarily have English as their primary language.
Yeah. I was driving from Northern California, like the Bay Area, down to San Diego, and I, because of what I study, you know, I'm putting on AM and I'm not picking up things. I'm kind of out in the desert, like above Bakersfield, and the dial's scanning, and then it comes upon a language. I wish I had recorded it, had something to record it. I'm thinking it was Cambodian or something. It was not Chinese. Somehow I could tell this is not Chinese, certainly not Spanish, wasn't French, German. And I guess there must be a small community, hyper small, but enough of them maybe working in a couple of factories or working in a few businesses that they could support a small radio station. And I regret not recording it, but you know, sometimes you just come across these fleeting, interesting moments in life.
Let's go to your calls and questions now about the future of AM radio at 1-800-642-1234, where Kay in Madison joins us. Kay, you're on the air with Noah Arsenault.
Thank you very much, and I agree with everything you're saying, and let me expand it. I'm somewhat communications trained as a result of the Coast Guard, and it's a bigger problem than this. When we went off analog, I can't remember what the other one is called, HM something or other. That was in June, as I remember, in 2010, exactly at 8 p.m. when I was living in New York City. On October 4th, 2010, I lost all five broadcast signals in New York City, and I never got them back. I talked to the director of broadcasting at the Empire State Building. He said, no, it didn't come from here. Years later, I found out it somehow it was a CB radio signal because October 4th is CB day, radio day. So it had to have been that. Somehow that just either stepped on my signal or blew off my signal. I'm not sure what.
Huh. That's very interesting. So you lost all your TV channels when it switched from analog?
Well, I didn't have cable because I was just recently retired, and I had just broadcast signal, which is also owned by the public. If you look at the legislation going back to 1928, all five TV stations in New York City at exactly 8 p.m. all went off the air.
Wow. Okay. I appreciate that. And one of the alternatives to AM has been the high definition radio and satellite radio, but those are all something that would be a little bit more, you'd have to upgrade to get that, right, Noah?
Correct. I'm not high definition. I've been hearing a lot about, but I don't know the details. Satellite radio, I find fascinating. The government typically does not like when a monopoly controls a form of communication. That's tended to be, something to look down upon. With satellite radio, the FCC and other government regulators actually said it's okay that there's only one satellite radio company, because when there were two, they weren't profitable.
Right.
And the companies argued that if you don't allow us to merge, you'll have zero satellite radio. So in this case, I think the government said, well, we'll have a monopoly in satellite radio, otherwise we won't have satellite radio. And if people don't like the opinions and music on satellite radio, there's a wide range. You can find things elsewhere. But I just find that very peculiar that we don't like monopolies controlling the form of communication, but satellite radio, it's okay.
But you'd have to have a monthly subscription in order to hear it.
Oh, that's exactly right.
And there's no localization of it either. It's all a national broadcast. Noah Arsenault, our guest, radio historian and media studies professor at San Diego State University, looking at the role of AM radio in our communities and the threat it is under right now. And efforts underway in Congress to perhaps mandate it in every car radio without any extra cost to a consumer. Did you listen to AM radio from far away when you were growing up with your old transistor? Would you miss it if it were not in your car today? You can join our conversation with Noah at 1-800-642-1234. You can also post your ideas up on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue our conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're continuing our talk with Noah Arsenault. He's a radio historian and media studies professor at San Diego State University. With us today to discuss the role of AM radio, as you may be listening to it right now and in Stevens Point or in Madison, because automakers are grappling with whether to keep it included in new vehicles. What would you do? 1-800-642-1234. Would you miss it were it gone? Do you have some fond memories of listening to AM radio back in the day, or perhaps right now? 800-642-1234. Let's go to Rana in Rice Lake. Rana, you're on the air with Noah Arsenault.
Hi. I'm really excited to tell you this. I don't know why. But when I was a kid growing up, we lived in a rural community. And WLS out of Chicago was the hottest, coolest, best radio station ever. But we could only get it on our AM radio at like 10:30 or 11 at night. So we always had to pretend like we were asleep and then get the radio out and try and find WLS. And we'd listen to it for as long as it would stay with us. So I am a AM radio fan, and I really hope it stays with us.
I appreciate the story, Rana. And Noah, it's funny that we talk about the power of localizing broadcasts with AM radio, but also overnights, as far as that signal can stretch. We get DXers from around the world who send us a letter to let us know that they heard us at this time, and this is what they heard. And they can do that from, just about anywhere on the globe at a certain time of night when the weather's right.
Yes. I'm glad you mentioned DXing. That was a very, very old practice. But yeah, you're right. Radio or all forms of media can work in sometimes contradictory manners. Marshall McLuhan has some saying about that. I'm not going to try and quote him. I'll get it wrong and probably no one would know anyway. But radio could form communities. It can sort of bring people together in their local community, but it can also connect communities over great geographic distances. I am really getting into Cajun music and Cajun radio. That's what I refer to as radio stations that broadcast in Louisiana French. And I can pick up those stations, some of those stations online from California. With a two-hour time zone difference, if I get up real early in the morning, real early in California, I can pick up KVPI. They do the French news at 7:30 each day. So that kind of makes me feel a little connected to Louisiana from a great distance. So yeah, radio can work both ways. It can sort of concentrate a community, but also form a community over a great geographic distance.
Well, one of the things I think of with the AM radio band is the rise of talk radio and how after the Telecommunications Act of, I think it was 1996, the consolidation of media and the rise of the likes of Rush Limbaugh and how it created not just an industry, but a kind of a political movement. And it was a way to connect people across the country from local radio stations.
It was the combination, not to cut you off, but it was the combination of the Telecommunications Act, I think it was 98, but also the decline of the fairness doctrine, which, you know, kind of was a gradual decline, but that doesn't exist anymore. And also the growth of portable phones, mobile phones. So now you have talk radio, the music has shifted to FM. They can air political opinions. They no longer have an obligation to even pretend to air the other side. They can be as lopsided as they want. And you have people driving home in the commute who can now call in and talk. So the explosion of talk radio is really quite fascinating. Even though I may not agree with a lot of it, I listen to a lot of different AM talk radio just to hear what's out there. And yeah, that has been quite, I don't think you can understand politics of the last 20 years if you don't understand talk radio.
Yeah, and specifically what you've heard on the AM band, because that's where radio groups, as they gathered, would generally put their talk radio stations if they had the bandwidth. I'm fascinated with it, and our guest, Noah Arsenault, radio historian and media studies professor at San Diego State University. We're taking a look at some of the car manufacturers who have considered pulling back on the AM receivers in their cars. And there was the hearing earlier today about whether or not the Congress should consider passing the AM for Every Vehicle Act. Be interested in knowing what you think before we're done this afternoon at 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to Peter in Stoughton next. Good afternoon, Peter.
Hi there. To follow up on what you just said, I read that some executive at Ford decided that no, they are not going to eliminate AM on their radios. Whereas a week ago, there was an uproar because they were among the manufacturers that were considering doing that. The reason I called was I grew up in a small city in upstate New York, and we had pretty good local radio stations, but I was also able to, for instance, pick up stations in Chicago. And I remember one night I heard something skipping up from Arizona. But in general, the formats were a lot more varied, that they weren't categorized like radio stations are now. And so you heard a much wider variety of music on any given station. And so I could hear what was going on in Chicago, and I could hear what was going on in Corning, three blocks from my home. So,
Peter, I appreciate the experience. And yeah, the playlist has become sort of standard across the country, Noah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I will admit the format. But you can occasionally find little pockets of cool, interesting stuff. I do have, I know we're coming up to the end here. I do have some thoughts about this mandating radio in every vehicle, though.
Yeah.
You would think I'd be 100%, yeah, let's do it. I'm generally in favor of it. But when I heard that, I was like, something in my went, huh, wait a minute. Because it makes me think of what's happened in some other countries in colonial India before the British left. They were bringing radios to the villagers to try and, quote unquote, modernize them, teach them the way they should be living, like good British subjects. they would put a radio in that you couldn't even change the dial, and it was sort of blasting or broadcasting whatever the British wanted. And Russia did the same thing in factories. They had, it was actually wired radio. I don't think the radio worked, so the factory speakers are connected by wire, but it's the same kind of thing. You couldn't change what was on it. So the mandating the form of media just made me think, wait a minute, that's maybe not encouraging more freedom. That could be some weird way of totalitarian control, but that's a Philip K. Dick conspiracy. I'm generally in favor of AM radio.
Rather Orwellian of you, Noah.
So, yes.
But take us into the future as you see it as a radio historian. What do you think it looks like for AM radio, satellite radio?
I think we're going to have, I do not think new forms of media replace the previous forms of media. They just make an ever more crowded media landscape. We still have traditional analog television. We have cable television. We have streaming. You can watch video on your phone. We have AM radio, FM radio, HD, satellite, podcasting. Podcasting and streaming, to me, is the newest evolution in radio. So I think we're just going to have more and more, which is great because this means more variety, but it also can be kind of overwhelming when you have so many options. But I think we're just going to see more and more options. We're not going to see fewer options.
And from here, Noah, we take you and put you up on our website and make you a podcast, from radio to a podcast at WPR.org. I want to thank you so much for joining us this afternoon, or whatever time it is when people are listening.
Yes, thank you.
Noah Arsenault is a radio historian and a professor at San Diego State University School of Journalism and Media Studies. He was with us today to discuss the importance of AM radio signals and a bipartisan effort that is underway to keep them as part of new vehicle manufacturing. We'll see how that turns out. And you can still comment on this on our Facebook page. The Ideas Network Facebook page is available to you, or email us anytime, ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, Ukraine's counteroffensive against Russian forces will peer through the fog of war with the help of an international security expert from UW-Madison. That's tomorrow on Central Time from 3 to 6. Coming up after the news, a Madison-based nonprofit's joining a growing list of microloan alternatives to payday lenders. We talk with the head of the program and a UW-Madison professor about the payday loan industry and the microloan alternatives. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. Today you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. Today you're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a school choice advocate joins us to make a case for allocating more state funds toward private voucher schools. First, a 2022 Pew study found Wisconsin residents who take out short-term payday loans deal with some of the highest costs across the country. Madison's branch of the nonprofit Society of St. Vincent de Paul is the latest group now attempting an alternate microloan program to traditional payday lenders. We'd like to know if you've borrowed from a payday lender before, and we'd love to have you share your experience with us. And I'm wondering what your changes you'd like to see in short-term microloan business. What do you think? 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us, ideas@WPR.org. Our guest, Julie Bennett, who's the executive director of the Madison branch of St. Vincent de Paul. And Julie, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Lee. It's a true pleasure to be here.
Also joining us this afternoon, J. Michael Collins, professor of public affairs and human ecology, where he is also the Fetzer Family Chair in Consumer and Personal Finance. He's also faculty director of the UW-Madison Center for Financial Security. Michael, welcome back to Central Time.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
And Julie, I'll begin with you today and give us an idea of what made your branch of the St. Vincent de Paul decide to try this microloan program.
This is a program that we've seen be successful in helping people who are coping with poverty and a couple of other places in the country who have been doing this for a number of years. Columbus, Ohio, and Dallas and North Texas really have seen the effect, not just of helping people avoid payday loans or get out from under payday loans, but also to develop a banking relationship. What they see is that access to money gives people a step up.
And Michael, give us some idea of the impact, the role that payday loan businesses play in the communities and the impact that they have.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, when somebody needs a payday loan, it's because it's not because they're doing it because they really want to. It's because they have to. They're out of money, and you know, maybe there's a bill due, maybe the rent's due, maybe they're looking at a late fee. So, you know, it's oftentimes something they're using as sort of a last ditch effort to try to get by. Yet, you know, in Wisconsin, we see a lot of families are in this position where they've, you know, either the income didn't come in this particular week or month that they expected, or the expenses are further beyond what they can handle. And, you know, oftentimes this is the last resort, the only way to get by are these short-term loans.
So what's the impact of families then when they take out these short-term loans and then face some of the highest interest rates across the country in Wisconsin when they work to pay them back?
Yeah, these, you know, the traditional payday loans, not the types of loans that the St. Vincent de Paul is doing,
right,
and other, you know, really responsible lenders are doing. Oftentimes what happens is people come into these with the best of intention. Maybe they borrow $500 or $1,000, and they think in 2 weeks, I got this. I'll get things back on track. I'll pay this off, and it'll be fine. 2 weeks comes, and actually all they can really do is pay the interest payment on that. So, you know, they just pay whatever that interest payment might be. Maybe it's $15 or $20, whatever it is. And they think, well, in two more weeks, I'll get this, and they don't. And so they continue to roll that loan over and over and over. And so they may spend $300-$400 on just the interest for what was originally a $500 loan. And that's where you get these really high interest rates that occur because people in the end just are a little too optimistic in terms of what they think they can handle, and they just can't get caught up again. And so a loan that has better terms, where you're actually paying back some of the principal and not just the interest, that can help people get to a position where they can actually pay it off and get back on their feet.
Which brings us to the role that the Medicine Branch of St. Vincent de Paul is looking to play in their microloan program in their community. And Julie Bennett, as I understand this, it's not just it's a lot more than a loan, isn't it?
It is. As we're beginning this program, what we see is the opportunity for people to become banked, as I said, but additionally, they will grow their credit score. They will get out of a cash economy, which is both expensive and dangerous, and they'll have the opportunity to work with our members who are the core piece of this on our side to have some ability or some opportunity to gain knowledge in financial literacy, to work with someone regularly on their budget, and to have access to other resources if there's any given month that they can't pay this loan, that they could tap into other resources that we make available in the community through our food pantry, our pharmacy, utility support, other kinds of basic assistance that may free up those dollars to help them make their loan payment as well.
That's Julie Bennett, who directs the Madison branch of St. Vincent de Paul, also joining us for this conversation. J. Michael Collins, professor of public affairs and consumer science at UW-Madison. And you can join the conversation as well as you look to make ends meet and what it takes. What do you see 1-800 in your community? That's 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. And Julie, how close are we to opening day and getting this program under a microloan program underway?
We're looking at about 6 weeks at this point. We, our friends over at the Bank of Sun Prairie have been our banking champion in this, and we're finalizing the legal agreement to make this happen. The way it will work is essentially St. Vincent de Paul will have funds on deposit at the bank, and we will qualify individuals for the loans, and then those people who are qualified go to the bank and they get the loan, and the bank will administer the loan, managing the payments and reporting to the credit bureau and those kinds of things.
And Michael Collins, you spoke about the payday loans in their community, but what about microloan systems like this, the one that St. Vincent de Paul is about ready to give a try?
You know, I think this is a fabulous type of approach. I mean, we'd like to say we should just, you know, raise a magic wand and get rid of payday loans. But the reality is that people still have trouble making ends meet. Only half of households, and it's even only about a third of lower income households, have any kind of emergency savings. So when they have a shortfall, it's really friends or family, or it's taking out an emergency loan. And so having some better alternatives to some of these high costs payday loans, auto title loans, you know, other kinds of products out there that are expensive and risky, is just a great thing. It pushes, I think, the good providers, the good lenders out there to do better. And in the long run, hopefully it pushes out some of these, you know, worse products that make people worse off.
Yeah, let's go to your calls and questions now as your experience as well. If you would like to share them, please join us, 1-800-642-1234, where we go to Linda in Eau Claire, who joins us this afternoon. Hi, Linda, you're on the air.
Well, the question I have is, why is it that no one is discussing the usurious interest rates and the greed and avarice of loan companies that prey on low-income people?
Linda, I appreciate the call. And Michael, I will begin with you, but I'd also like to hear what you'd think about this, Julie. But Michael, why does Wisconsin have some of the highest short-term interest rates on payday loans in the country?
You know, this is a choice that our legislators in our state have made. There are other states where the highest interest rates are actually regulated, where the state says, no, you know, you can't have loans at those rates. The argument I've heard among our policymakers in our state is that, well, even if they were to ban it, then people would still find another way to get these loans. They go to an online lender or some sort of other type of loan product that may be not even in the regulated system. So it's better to have it expensive but in the regulated system. I think that's debatable, but that's kind of where we're at as a state. You know, Minnesota is currently contemplating a law that would effectively ban payday loans. So, again, it's a choice that the legislators of our state have made.
And Julie, as I read in at CapTimes.com, you spoke with legislators on both sides of the aisle about payday loans. And what did they have to tell you?
What I heard from legislators on both sides of the aisle is people don't have an alternative to payday lending. You know, Michael alluded to that it is the resource people have when they need immediate access to money. And while that may be true, I'm not willing to accept that as something that has to remain true. We can offer an alternative to payday lending. My hope is that we can show that this is a way that this can be done, and we can be joined by others in the community to create a big enough access between our community banks and our larger banks and our nonprofits. There's enough money to do this. It's just, can we create enough access to the money? And if we can demonstrate a program that works, that becomes replicable, then we create an alternative to payday lending, and then the legislature can take it up from a different perspective.
Hey, Julie, are you able to stick around with us a little bit longer here this afternoon?
Sure.
I'd appreciate that. Yeah, our guest, Julie Bennett, who directs the Madison branch of St. Vincent de Paul, also joining us, J. Michael Collins, professor of public affairs and consumer science at UW-Madison. And you're welcome to as well at 1-800-642-1234. If you've had experience with payday lenders, conversation. In a matter of weeks. And Michael, I want to ask a little more about how we see the money reverberate through the economy. Why haven't we seen more of these microloan programs that Julie talked about? We've seen in North Texas be successful, in Columbus and Ohio be successful, and we're about ready to see tried out in Madison.
Yeah, I mean, these programs do exist. They, you know, there are some credit unions around the state that have done these. There have been some other nonprofits that have done these. They tend to be relatively small. I think where it's tough is that the big, payday lending companies have the ability to advertise. They have storefronts. They have bus ads. They have lots of ways to get in front of people. And so some of these smaller programs, which are oftentimes you know, much more in the consumer's benefit, just don't get traction. They don't get the attention. And so, and you know, people end up already in that storefront, already cutting a deal before they realize they have some other option.
Yes, the payday loan companies, they've got billboards, they've got advertising. You make a good point, and you know, you'd want to keep that money in the micro programs for the loans that are available. So, Julie, having said that, now, how do we get people who are interested and in need in the Madison community connected with this micro loan program?
People will start through our member organization. We have members in 18 Catholic churches who visit people in need in their homes to learn about their needs. And as they learn that a payday loan is in someone's life, either they're contemplating one or they're already using one, they will make referrals back to us. We will work with that family to evaluate their ability to repay a loan, and we'll send them to the bank to get that loan. It will be a slow process to start as we learn with them how to do this. We have had great mentoring from Columbus and North Texas, but we live in Madison and we'll have to figure out how to do things the Madison way. But there again, I go back to as we grow, There's a lot of buzz around this. It's an exciting thing. We see other nonprofits already reaching out to us to say we want to help too. And I think if we can generate that buzz and continue to grow the interest and the commitment, which is a big piece, that we will see the money come. And as the money comes and the availability of the loans grows, my hope and my expectation is that that takes on a life of its own.
Yeah, there are St. Vincent de Paul chapters throughout Wisconsin and beyond our state borders. So has there been any interest from other St. Vincent de Paul chapters around Wisconsin that are watching what you do, Julie, and maybe following suit?
I think at this point they're watching what we're doing here in Madison. Our district council here in Madison is one of the largest in the nation, and we have capacity to do things in a bigger way than some of the other organizations in the state and across the country, which allows us to have the funds to get this started. But I think there's eyes on to see how it might be replicated, both in Madison with other nonprofits and with St. Vincent de Paul's elsewhere in the state and in the country.
And Michael Collins, you mentioned the economic impact for families, but how do the economic impacts for microloans versus payday loans, high interest loans versus community loans and the community support that St. Vincent de Paul is looking to provide through these microloans, how does that compare?
You know, the anytime that we can keep more money in people's pockets, that benefits the local economy. So, you know, if the alternative is that people are paying overdraft fees, they're paying, you know, hundreds of dollars in interest, and instead that is money that they're able to actually spend on other things that are important to them, or, you know, able to make their ends meet for the other bills that they might have, that helps them. It helps keep their own financial security higher, and it also keeps some of that money local. The fact that this is a local lender and a local loan pool as well, I mean, this is all sort of feeding into our local economy and not only stabilizing families, but keeping some of that capital right here. So, you know, it's hard to put a big number on this, but still, it's going to definitely make a difference for the people who are able to take out these loan products.
And how would other communities begin the process of looking at developing a microloan program in a way that would benefit and ripple through the community like that?
Michael? Did you want me to take that one?
Well, I you both can answer it, but Julie, yeah, if you've got an answer, go ahead and step in.
So step one is truly to have a pot of money. And we have been able to set aside funds, and we have had generous donations that have allowed us to grow that pool of funds that we are able to make available for our loans. Step two is a lending partner, and Bank of South Prairie has stepped up to be our first lending partner here, but because we have been able to develop this idea from successful programs elsewhere, three other banks in the community are ready to say, when you are ready, we want to partner with you in this as well. They see the benefit to the community. They see the benefit to the neighbors who will use these programs, and they get to talk about good that they're offering in the community as well. This is a win for everyone, but you have to show that it's viable, because while we at the Society of St. Vincent de Paul here in Madison is taking the financial risk and we're willing to do that, you know, the bank is taking on administrative costs that for very small loans. They don't make money on these, and they are in business to make money. So they, you know, you have to find somebody willing to be on that side of it. But one of the things that is close to my heart in this is we know that there are people who, if you are living on, you know, $700 or $800 a month in disability income, you will never have the capacity to pay back a loan. We need to look for other solutions for people who can't make that loan payment. And we do that. But for those people who can make that loan payment and don't have access to it, we need to open that door, help them establish a banking relationship, help them not have to pay 10 or 15 or 20% of their income simply to cash their paycheck. And that gives people a step up on that path out of poverty.
Michael, when communities hear about these microloan programs, they are a fraction of the lending business and industry. And as Julie Bennett mentioned there, there's got to be some financial incentive. But how can you make programs like this grow in communities across the country and here in Wisconsin, where we've got some of the highest payday loan interest rates in the country?
Well, you know, I think there's reasons to be optimistic. I mean, we've seen cases where financial products that were considered to be, you know, risky or, you know, outlandish. So like loans for first-time home buyers or loans for small businesses. And today they're, you know, they're kind of part and parcel of what many lending institutions do. So definitely there can be these sort of leading edge programs that eventually push the market to be more responsive to the consumer needs, and sometimes offering a product that's actually more competitive. And so in the long run, I think these are really important to try to push the market and do some of this, you know, R&D work, if you want to think about it that way, to try to push the market to a better place. Will it happen overnight? No, but that's why we need these kinds of programs, to try to show what's possible and hopefully get some of these lenders who are willing to take a risk, who are willing to do something to engage maybe some customers who they're currently not working with to be, you know, part of their system. And in the long run, maybe you know, a really loyal customer that they can have over the long run.
Yeah, through life and over generations within a family. Julie, one of the aspects at CapTimes.com that you mentioned was the story at CapTimes.com was the Catholic churches that make up the St. Vincent de Paul in Madison are, in your words, largely old and white, and you want to reach out to communities of color and those who are most in need. And how are you plan to go about that?
I think it's a challenge for all of us in Madison who, you know, the people who have access to money in Madison are largely older and white people. And so we reach out in this community through similar channels as we all do, the, you know, using social media and our website and advertising and through our members, through our member organization. People find us through 211 as often as they find us any other way. We, for many years, have been the agency in Dane County that receives the most referrals from 211 because we provide programming for people to meet basic needs, food and medicine and housing support and utility bills. And we know that people will continue to find us that way. Yeah. We have been doing intentional outreach and will continue to do so to other agencies represented by people of color, people who are less represented in our community for many years.
And
to
Julie,
develop
We'll have to leave it there, but I thank you so much for joining us today. Julie Bennett's the executive director of the Madison chapter of St. Vincent de Paul, looking to get their microloan program underway in a matter of weeks. Also joining us, J. Michael Collins, professor of public affairs and consumer science at UW-Madison. Coming up after the news, we take a look at school choice in the state budget. This is Central Time.